very quiet. You hear that? It's the sound of an American woodcock. You know, a timber dude. You know, a bog sucker. Also known as a hokum poke. It's my new favorite bird, I gotta tell you. I'm Jabalani LaFall, amateur YouTube bird video watcher. And on today's Central Standard, we're gonna hear what's going on with these birds and other critters in the KC metro area this winter. And find out where you can go to listen to bird calls on your own. Or if you're really lucky, watch one of these little bad boys dance. These birds got the moves. And stick around for Nature in the City on today's Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. With nicknames like Timber Doodle, Bog Sucker, Night Partridge, Brush Snipe, and Hokum Poke, no bird struts his stuff like the American woodcock. But when the fun name roll call stops and there's a more sober reminder about this bird, the woodcock is considered the species of greatest conservation need. Their U.S. population drops about 1% annually due to deforestation. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Once again, it's time for Nature in the City as we examine the many names of this endangered bird and where it lurks here in the metro, as well as examining chorus frogs and other wild wonders as we do on Nature in the City. Kansas City, this is 2012's first rendition of Nature in the City on Central Standard. What's been going on outside your window? What mysterious critters have you pondered over or found in unexpected places? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And you can hit us up on Facebook, and our Twitter handle is at KCURCST. And the email, of course, is centralstandard@kcur.org. And over on KCUR's Facebook page, we're hosting a quiz. Compete to be the first to name this green bird spotted in KCK, and we'll name our Central Standard Bird Watcher of the Month later in the program. Meanwhile, joining us live are, once again, Joe Warner, urban ecologist and biologist, and Larry Rizzo, natural history biologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation and the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center. Welcome back. I guess I should say Happy New Year in February to you gentlemen, because this is the first time in the year you joined us.
That's right. Good Happy morning. New Year.
So tell us about this American woodcock. And I guess the first question is, why does it have so many names?
It's an odd-looking bird.
Night partridge, brush snipe, hokum poke, timber doodle, bog sucker. What's going on?
It's an odd-looking bird with very odd behavior. The mating behavior is just really incredible, and we'll be starting to see that here pretty soon. You know, when the temperature gets over 60 degrees on nice evenings and mornings, the birds will be in flight doing that mating display that, you know, just gives it a it's a wonderful, different nature experience to get out and see that.
Larry Rizzo, do you know why they've given this bird so many names?
No, I just agree with Joe. If you know what that bird looks like and have ever observed it, it's an odd bird in a lot of ways. For example, it's considered a shore bird, but it's found in upland areas, so it's not one you find near shores and lakes and marshes or anything like that. And it's kind of a I hate to denigrate it, but it's kind of a fat, dumpy bird.
Fat, dumpy bird.
With a long beak, very odd looking, and has this really incredible courtship display, though, that's really quite beautiful.
And a strut. Walks with a strut.
It does.
And the way they fly through the timber, I guess that's part of the timber doodle name. They have a very erratic flight. You know, you can imagine flying through trees and trying to miss all the branches and things. You know, they dodge and weave, and just are excellent flyers.
And the bog sucker comes from, I mean, their main diet is earthworms, and so they do probe for those in damp soil.
So where do these timber doodles, bog suckers, night partridge, brush snipes, hokum pokes, American woodcocks, where do they congregate locally?
Well, there's a number of places you can see them. The habitat for them is old fields, kind of grown-up grassy areas with woody thickets close by, that type of thing. Some of the better places around would be Longview, the lands around Longview Lake, Lake Jacomo, Blue Springs Lake, probably on the Kansas side. I would guess Shawnee Mission Park probably hosts some of them out along the Blue River and some of the public land out that way.
What's the best time, Joe Werner, for spotting these unique
creatures? They fly at dawn and dusk, and really dusk is probably the best time to see them. That's when they do this incredible flight display that Larry was talking about.
But if you're looking at them at dusk, would you only know them by their unorthodox or incredible flight display and not necessarily by their colors or bodily dimensions?
Well, like many birds, the best way to identify them is by the sounds that they make.
Let's listen to what these birds sound like so you can lock it in your mind, listeners, as we talk about the American woodcock and where you can find it locally. Let's check it out. Shh. I was just going to let that go on so we could get a sense of what it sounds like. You have to be very quiet when you're out.
That's right. And that's the call that they make when they're sitting on the ground trying to attract a mate.
That's the start of their display will be that sound. That's the important one to key into if you're trying to find them. It's really recognizable. You're going to hear it right at last light of the day. And again, in the early morning hours, full moon night, they may do this off and on all night long. It's tied specifically to the intensity of the light.
So tell us about this unique mating ritual and how it starts. You said the intensity of the light, the sound we just heard.
They will start with that little sound, and what they're doing there is sitting on the ground, and it's usually kind of a little bare spot. And while he's doing that, he's turning around 360, so he's projecting that out. And after he makes that little nasal sound for a while, he'll fly up into the air and he'll start off in a big, wide circle. And as he's ascending, you will hear this twittering coming from, which is actually produced by the wings of the bird. Mm-hmm. And he will ascend up into the sky. And as he ascends, the spiral gets tighter and tighter and tighter until he's at the culmination of it. He's way up in the air, just a speck, if anything, often goes out of sight. Then begins to swoop down in big arcing spirals back toward the ground. And when the bird's doing that, it makes an entirely different sound, which is this very strange singing, warbling sound that sounds like a songbird, a very odd mm-hmm. sound coming out of a bird like that.
So you have this spinning and twisting and going up in the air and coming back down and going 360, and they're updating you on social media at the same time. You said that bird is twittering at the same time. That's a multifaceted bird.
And he goes back to that same spot on the ground, makes that nasal sound, begins it all over again.
Yeah. And does it in less than 140 characters.
I'll leave that one alone.
Has the mild weather had anything to do with the migratory patterns of the American woodcock and other types of birds, or is it pretty much the same?
Well, the thing about bird migrations is generally tied to day length. Birds in nature have evolved with a pretty sharp system in mind that they're not going to get fooled too much by warm spells or cold, unusual cold weather, and they'll go by the day length, which is the same every year. So
they're leaving anyway, right, Joe?
Right, they're leaving, but sometimes the birds from the northern part of the United States and from Canada get pushed south by the weather. So they may not go all the way south to the Gulf. As an example, I think right now there's about 1 million snow geese up at Squaw Creek National Wildlife Refuge in northwest Missouri.
And they don't usually stop.
Early for that.
They don't usually stop.
Well, they'll stop, but just go as far south as the open water is. And this has been such a mild winter that they've actually been in the area most of the winter.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. It's Nature in the City once again, folks. Our regular guests are here. Joe Werner, he's a biologist and urban ecologist, and Larry Rizzo, a natural history biologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation and the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center right across the street from KCUR studios here. Kansas City, what's been going on outside your window? What mysterious critters have you thought about, pined for, pondered over, or found in unexpected places during this mild winter? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And our Twitter handle is @KCURCST. Email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Tell us about your finds on this Nature in the City episode. And by the way, this American woodcock of many names, the bog sucker, the night partridge, brush snipe, and hokum poke. It does the hokum poke and turns itself around and also does twittering things. We've been finding out about it. Why is it endangered, Larry Rizzo?
Well, technically it's not. The endangered is a specific category is labeled that by a regulatory agency. So its numbers may be declining.
Yeah, let me back out of that. Why is it considered, quote, a species of greatest conservation need, which is what the
from what you indicated earlier, the loss of habitat, I assume, would be the biggest factor in that. There's probably also some, and I don't know, I haven't researched this or anything, but I'm guessing its diet of earthworms would be places where, you know, if it's in an agricultural situation, we've used a lot of chemicals in places that may not have the food source there in some cases.
We got Dan in KCK. Welcome to Central Standard. Hello, Dan.
Hi. Hi, Javelani. I was just wondering if you're best would comment on how common chestnut-sided warblers are in this area. I've had one all winter at my house, and this is the first year I've ever seen one.
Chestnut-sided warblers.
Yes, sir.
How common are those, Larry Rizzo?
Well, that's a bird we see in limited numbers in spring migration in the month of May. So having one here and now would be very unusual. I've never heard of one here in the winter personally.
No. What might it be if it's not that?
I'm not saying it's not that. I mean, occasionally we will have warblers that are in the winter. It's very unusual, though. Is there a way you can get a photograph of that bird?
Pardon? I'm not a photographer, but I see him daily on my feeder, and he's been here all winter.
What time of day does it come out, Dan?
Most of them feed most intensely in the morning, and he seems to get along well with the cardinals and all the other regulars. I don't know what the mate might look like. I'm kind of hoping he's got one here.
Thank you, Dan, for your contribution to the conversation. Does that give you more of a clue, Joe Werner, on when the bird comes to feed and the fact that it gets along with the other birds? Or is that
Oh, no. Birds group together to travel around the feeders, you know, with chickadees and cardinals and things of that sort. I would suggest to Dan that if he knows someone that is a photographer, that he would invite them over to get a picture of that bird. I think that would be very interesting to document that.
I'd be very interested in seeing that.
Suggest to Dan that in the age of social media and instant gratification and instant nature observations, that he just go ahead, snap that picture, put it up on KCUR's Facebook page, or email it in the Central Standard at kcur.org. Speaking of which, Max and KCK shares a photo of a snow owl he took near the Smithville Lake over email. And you can do the same, as I mentioned, at centralstandard@kcur.org. He asked, I wonder what happened to the snow owls since then. We don't know when he took the photo exactly, but where did the snow owls go? Larry Rizzo, how are the snow owls doing? There's only one instance of light snow so far. Does a snow owl need snow to distinguish itself as a snow owl?
Well, snow probably helps a snowy owl because they will blend in with that. But the answer to how they're doing is probably not one most people want to hear, because most of those owls that are down here in the winter are going to die. They're not going to make it back to their nesting grounds.
Why is that?
A lot of reasons, but it just basically boils down to they're a bird of the tundra. So they get down here. They come from places where there's no people, there's different predators, there's no trees, there's no power lines, there's no cars. Their diet, the habitat is different, what they hunt in. They're just not equipped to survive here. I've personally taken about five of them over to the museum at KU this past winter, and several have been hit by cars. One flew into a power line. Mm-hmm. One was probably hit by a train. One simply starved to death, but all of them are severely underweight when we get them in there. So it's nature's way, basically, of resettling the population up there.
How do they end up down here this far south if they're tundra?
Well, they're driven down here in winters when the lemming population crashes is the thinking. Lemmings are very cyclical, and the snowy owl, being a main predator of the lemmings, follows their population very closely, but there's some lag to that. So, in other words, when the lemming population's high, snowy owls reproduce a lot, and there's a lot more of them. Then the lemming population crashes, and you have lots of snowy owls around suddenly without enough to eat. and so they're forced farther south than they would normally come. It's a migratory bird, so it's common around, you know, the Great Lakes states and southern mm-hmm. Canada, but it's very unusual. This is an unprecedented year for them in Missouri. We've never had so many here.
Snowy owls.
Yes.
Yeah, the Midwest in Missouri and Kansas has seen more snowy owls this year than the last 100 years. It's really been impressive. You know, as Larry said, a lot of them may not make it back. You know, they may not be able to find food, as Larry said. There's starvation is a big part of the mortality of those birds down here. And they've made it as far south as Oklahoma and Arkansas.
And again, it's the lemming population up north that causes
ground.
This influx that we've seen, this unprecedented influx.
Yeah, that's what's believed to drive it.
Speaking of migratory patterns, Kate and Lawrence wants to know more about the migratory patterns of our woodcocks we were talking about at the top of the hour. When do they leave the area?
They come through here in the fall, and I've seen them as late as December. And mm-hmm. as Joe mentioned, in particularly mild winters, you know, they may stick around a good part of the winter. But they normally migrate to the Gulf Coast area.
Mm-hmm. We had a guy mention cardinals earlier. The Cardinals won the World Series this year, and they're still singing about it in Missouri. But the birds are singing away every morning these days. Is that peculiar?
No, that's mm-hmm. a great thing. Glad somebody mentioned that. That's one of the first optimistic signs of spring, yeah. And they'll start singing as early as January. But you go out on a clear, calm morning right now, and you're going to hear cardinals singing.
Mm-hmm. Is there a particular cadence of the singing or a particular pitch where we know it's spring, or maybe they're balking, or maybe it's the just warming up the vocal cords? Do we know by the sound?
Just a typical song that they sing is you know, what most people are familiar with in their backyard. And actually, woodcock, will nest. One of the best places to see them is at the Jerry Smith Park out in South Kansas City. And I've seen them nesting out there, and it's a wonderful place to watch them display.
You got Jan in Northland. Welcome mm-hmm. to Central Standard, Jan.
Hi there. Yeah. We have red-winged blackbirds that come through mostly in the spring. You know, they haven't been around much, but the other day, and I've noticed this last winter too, we had a large flock of them come to the feeder for a little while, and the thing is, these were mostly, almost all, the striped, brown stripe, you know, and I knew that they were red-winged blackbirds, but I can't ever figure out how to tell the immatures, which have the striped, according to the bird books, you know, the striped pattern, and the females, and I can't figure, you know, so I've got like a flock of 20-some, almost 30 out front eating, and most of them are not mature males. Most of them are the striped configuration, and I can't tell, okay, how many are just immature young ones, male or female, and how many are females.
So what are you looking? What are you looking for in particular, Jan?
Pardon?
What are you looking for in particular?
Well, I'm just wondering, the designation in my bird books, you know, the description doesn't really give me a real good clue if there is any good way to tell them apart and tell, okay, that's a mature female red-winged blackbird, and these are just young ones that, you know, will get their grown-up feathers later on.
Thank you, Jan. Larry, Joe, she wants to know about distinguishing red-winged blackbirds.
Well, as she pointed out, the females and the young are brown with some stripes on the breast and all, and the males are solid black. The young males are going to be going through their molt right now and getting their breeding plumage. So that's probably the key right now is to start watching for that.
If it's not spelled out in the field guide, it's probably because you can't easily tell them apart.
Yeah.
Casey writes in with this question, we recently moved to a wooded area, and we've seen and heard coyotes. One afternoon, they were in our garage close to the house. Are coyotes dangerous? What should we do? Have they seen and heard coyotes? Could it have been something else during this time, or did they maybe see some coyotes?
No, they can definitely be coyotes. I mean, they're in the urban areas and suburban areas around here, and one that's bold enough to enter a garage or come close to your garage is not a good thing. I mean,
you might even say it's wily.
Yeah. The biggest thing to watch out for, of course, they will take your pets. If you have small, you know, dogs or cats, they will kill those. But
they're not known for confronting humans right off.
It's happened.
On their habit.
It's
on their
happened.
Habitat.
It's extremely unusual. Extremely in Southern California, in the Los Angeles area, there were some really horrific incidents of coyotes attacking, in one case killing a small child once. But I don't want to get – I don't want to overblow that because that's just extremely unusual. But
and in those cases, it's usually in the coyote's habitat, maybe not in a garage, maybe on a path or a hiking path or somewhere
this was
out
actually
in those desert
in,
areas.
In a neighborhood.
Yeah, out in those desert hilly areas that they come in. But, and you never want to see that.
But in general, it's just – it's not a good thing to see any wild creature that's becoming so acclimated to people that it loses fear, whether that's a coyote, a fox, a raccoon, or a possum, or whatever.
So acclimated to people that it loses fear. That's an interesting
– Well, and sometimes they'll be diseased and wander into someone's yard, and that's certainly an issue that you don't want to deal with. You don't want to be around them.
That's nature in the city, folks. Cully in Westport, seeing a lot of eagles, saw some hunting geese. Are you guys seeing that too, Larry Rizzo and Joe Warner, hunting geese? It's snow goose hunting season that's underway. Any changes in regulations we should know about hunting geese? What's going on with those?
There is the special snow goose hunting season. It's called the light goose season, but it's targeted at snow geese right now, which is quite liberal, and it's been going on for quite a while. And the reason for that is the snow goose population is really exploded. And
why is that?
They benefit from the large-scale industrial agriculture probably more than anything. Mm-hmm. Acres and acres of unbroken cornfields are just a banquet for them, and their population's been growing and growing to the extent that they're damaging their own habitat on the tundra, which is a very serious thing. So that's why we really need to reduce their population.
Wow. What about the eagles?
Well, the eagles often follow the snow geese. The eagles by the way, this winter, due to the mild weather and all the open water everywhere, we have not seen the concentrations of them that we would in some winters. Does not mean the eagle population is still very, very healthy. Lots of eagles are doing very well, but we just haven't seen the numbers this year. But they follow those snow geese, and that's a main source of food, particularly crippled and injured and sick ones.
Tyler, welcome to Central Standard.
Well, thank you for having me. I am from Nevada, and I often would hear this beautiful bird, many Nevadans would, and it has a very distinct sound, and it goes like this. I hope I can do it justice.
You're going to do it.
Do, 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 do. And it was just a beautiful sound, and I moved to Kansas City, and I thought, I'll never hear that lovely bird again. And lo and behold, I was feeling very homesick, and I woke up one morning to that lovely chirp, and I just couldn't believe it. And I was wondering if you might know what that bird is.
Well, I like this.
Bird.
It's kind of like
name
car
that
talk.
Tune. Name that
like,
bird.
It's like car talk when people describe their noises their cars make. I like it. We're thinking chickadee.
Chickadee.
Sounds similar to one of the many different sounds a black-capped chickadee could make. You can get online and you can find recordings of those about any bird if you dig around a little bit and see if you can hear that and see if that sounds like it.
Tyler, what you may have heard, as we just heard from Larry Rizzo of the Missouri Department of Conservation, is that that may indeed be a chickadee. Thank you for being so courageous on live radio as to show us that sound. We've recently started to get more wintry weather, but almost 2 months in, we haven't had our deep freeze yet, per se. Will this affect insect populations at all, and by extension, birds?
Well, you know, that's a tough question. If you look at last year as an example, where we had a very, very difficult winter, the insect population came through, very well. I talked to many gardeners as an example that had a lot of problems with insects in their gardens. It does depend to some degree on, you know, the particular species you're talking about, but I think they'll do pretty well this year. They've been around for many, many, many years, millennium, and they've adapted to changes like that.
Is that a tough call on the insect population and how it might affect birds, Larry Rizzo?
Yeah, it's as Joe mentioned, it's kind of tough to generalize, but there are some things. You know, mild winters, grasshoppers, for instance, I've seen survive all winter long, and they're supposed to die in the wintertime. As any vet will tell you, the flea population is worse in mild winters the following year, that kind of thing. So it depends, but, yeah, it will have an impact on some of those.
James in Raytown, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I have responsibility for several football fields out here in this area, and we've got a horrible problem with, I don't know, the geese or ducks or whatever. Boy, they make a mess out of everything. How do I get rid of these things?
Something's on the football field, and it's wreaking havoc on the gridiron. What birds are known to migrate around football fields and get into three-point stances?
Yeah, more than likely, we're talking about Canada geese. They their population has just soared. And
Canadian rules football.
Yeah, unfortunately, but they'll get on golf courses, football fields, and all. And I would suggest that, James, you probably try to talk to the Missouri Conservation Department and see if they can provide some assistance for you, or the United States Department of Agriculture, it's called, the acronym is APHIS, A-P-H-I-S, can possibly help you to try to chase those birds away.
You heard the advice, James. Holler at the Missouri Department of Conservation. Don't want to just run them off wholesale. It's Nature in the City here on Central Standard. Our regular guests are here, Joe Warner, biologist and urban ecologist, and Larry Rizzo, a natural history biologist with the aforementioned Missouri Department of Conservation and the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, chorus frogs and more from you, our listening audience, on what you've experienced out and about during this mild winter so far and what's been going on. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Call in or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. This is Nature in the City on Central Standard. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. It is Nature in the City here on Central Standard, the first installment of 2012. Our regular guests are here, Joe Warner, a biologist and urban ecologist, and Larry Rizzo, a natural history biologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation and the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center. Over on Facebook's page, we had hosted a quiz, and we wanted you to be the first to name a green bird spotted in Kansas City, Kansas. And our winner is Dave Tanner, who wrote, "That is a green-tailed towhee." A green-tailed towhee. What do we know about a green-tailed towhee?
Well, green-tailed towhees are not very common around here. It's a bird of the mountains, the shrubby areas of the West. Right now, they would typically be down in Mexico, southern United States, Texas, Arizona. So it's very unusual that they would show up here, although it's not the first one that's ever showed up here. It's just pretty neat that they're around.
Congrats, Dave. You are the Central Standard Bird Watcher of the Month, as it were. Why are these green-tailed birds coming down and dipping their toes on the trees?
Well, you know, it's difficult to say, but, you know, if you look at the weather patterns that we've had recently, there's a lot of storms that have been coming out of the Southwest. Sometimes these birds do get blown off. You know, we'll have birds like mountain bluebirds, as an example, that, you know, would be blown across the prairies of Kansas and end up over here in the wintertime. But the towhee, you know, it's, as we were talking about earlier, you know, it's found very commonly with other birds. In this instance, it was with chickadees and cardinals and birds of that sort at a feeder, you know, feeding on the ground, you know, on the seed that the person had put out their feeder. So, and I think this is probably a good example. There's just a lot of people out there now that are looking more than in the past, people that are interested in feeding birds in the backyard and watching them. And as a matter of fact, starting tomorrow for the next 4 days, the Cornell Lab and the Audubon Society and the local Burroughs Audubon Society are sponsoring the Great Outdoor Backfeed Bird Count. And if someone wanted to go online to the Cornell Lab or the Audubon Society website, they could learn about that and perhaps participate in that.
Definitely might be worth checking out. Hal writes in wanting to know, what's the latest info on the ivory-billed woodpecker? The ivory-billed woodpecker. Any spottings? What is the latest dope on the ivory-billed woodpecker?
I have not heard anything about that very recently. My guess is you won't. And there is, let's just say, considerable evidence now and speculation that there never was one present down there.
Well, there was one that people were saying was present down in Arkansas. I think that's what you're
right.
referring to in north
that's
central it. Arkansas.
So the ivory-billed woodpecker in this region is kind of like Elvis. It's a sighting, but, you know, turns out it's not quite what you thought it was.
The likely scenario is that bird was a pileated woodpecker, which is a native species that's relatively common in the right habitat that had some unusual color patterns on its wings.
Speaking of woodpeckers, Lindsay in Prairie Village writes that yesterday she saw what she considered to be a red-headed woodpecker out at their bird feeder. Nothing too out of the ordinary, but later in the day, a different woodpecker was attempting to get seed from the same feeder, but it was more than twice the size of the original woodpecker. It had similar markings, but the head was not as bright colored. Any idea what that might have been? A bigger woodpecker came along move the red-headed woodpecker out of the way.
I'm guessing that was a flicker, which is not most of our woodpeckers.
More social media, man. Yeah. Photographs this time, a flicker.
Most of our woodpeckers have a black and white pattern to them. And the flicker is predominantly the overall color of a flicker. It has a lot of different colors and patterns on it, but it's mostly brownish. So if that
is that considered
familiar,
a woodpecker?
It is a woodpecker.
Mm-hmm. That is a type of woodpecker.
Yep.
Well, let's move on. Missouri has more than 26 species and subspecies of toads and frogs. In Kansas City, we even have what's known as the Tota Loop, and that includes Penn Valley Park, Kessler Park, and Holland Park, all within the loop's boundaries, green spaces with wildlife. Is that a coincidence, the Tota Loop? Does it have anything to do with frogs and toads?
The Boy, total loop. I'm not sure how that name came about.
I'm just getting word in breaking news. The Total Loop is actually a notorious community that was adjacent to the Kansas River near Greystone Heights and has nothing to do with amphibious animals, but unsavory characters during our Depression era and Prohibition era. But we still have plenty of toads and frogs in the region, don't we, Joe?
Oh, absolutely.
The Total Loop. I mean, who knew?
Exactly.
You learn something new every day on Central Standard.
There we go. Yeah. Wonderful.
Basic question. What's the difference between frogs and toads?
There are several differences. Now, the distinction gets kind of fuzzy because there are some toads that not all these characters hold fast. Mm-hmm. But toads, generally speaking, have a dry skin. They're more terrestrial as they live on land. Believe it or not, frogs have teeth. Mm-hmm. They're in the back of their jaw. You don't see
frogs
them.
Frogs have teeth.
Yeah, they don't have fangs. You can't see them. But anatomically, there is a little difference there. But generally speaking, frogs are more aquatic, have a moister skin. Now, of course, toads lay their eggs in the water like most amphibians do. But they're more terrestrial, drier skin.
Let's talk about the chorus frogs. What are they up to this time of year?
They're starting to wake up.
They're starting to wake up.
We should be hearing them soon.
And so the western chorus frog, what are they doing and where can they be found?
Well, when they wake up and come out, they like company. Let's just put it that way this time of year. And they'll be calling from roadside ditches, any little ponds or depressions that hold water that don't have fish in them. And the male chorus frogs will be chorusing and trying to attract females.
And to get a sense what these male chorus frogs may be doing to attract these female chorus frogs, just to give you a prelude to their performance, let's hear from our male chorus of frogs right now. Sounds like a hunk of burning love to me from those male chorus frogs. This is Nature in the City on Central Standard, just in case you are wondering. It's not a Budweiser commercial. There are chorus frogs. Now, chorus frogs, Joe Warner and Larry Rizzo, are unique in that they're valuable in determining the health of an ecosystem. How so?
Well, they're, you know, very susceptible to insecticides and herbicides, as we were talking about earlier. And, you know, if there's a healthy population of them around, you know, it's, as you're saying, it's a good sign of the health of the environment. The you know, it's, you know, down at the you know, one of the bases of the animal food web food chain.
Amphibians in general are a good indicator of ecological health, and that's why it's so alarming that a lot of amphibian populations have been declining.
Mm-hmm.
Amphibians have a permeable skin. They spend part of their lives in aquatic situations and part on land. They have the potential to absorb toxins through the air, water, soil, everywhere.
So that makes them a good barometer.
Yeah, in general, that's a safe statement, yeah.
Christy, welcome to Central Standard. Calling from the South Plaza, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, hi. I just wanted to ask your experts about my squirrels. I kind of looked this up online, but I had noticed that they were all losing their fur, especially from, like, their chest up. And it was just horrible. There was, you know, probably five or six of them that seemed to not have any fur anymore. And so has anybody else experienced this?
Christy wants to know, are squirrels shaving their chests when they go out on the plaza?
I have not heard of anything like that, Christy. It's occasionally you see that. I would tend to think of it more in late summer and probably associated with fleas or other external parasites.
Would hair loss have something to do with a more mild weather?
No, I think that, as Larry said, the parasites that may be in the nests is perhaps contributing to this.
Perhaps they have survived the winter, and it's more severe now than in a normal year.
Mm-hmm. Brad in Prairie Village, welcome to Central Standard Nature in the City.
Hi there. I thought I heard what was a cell phone on a table, and I went over, and there wasn't a cell phone there, and I was sitting by the fireplace, and I started hearing this, rah, rah, and it sounded like a piece of metal going through a wood chipper. So I went outside and looked, and there's a woodpecker on top of my fireplace drumming on the metal chimney cap, announcing that he and the wife had found my wood pile, and it was full of bugs, and this place was theirs.
Wow. A woodpecker that sounded kind of like a cell phone. The vibrating of a cell phone, is that kind of what you mean? Not the ringing, but the vibrating of it. Yeah.
Vibrating cell phone on a metal table, and got over closer to where I thought the cell phone charger was, and the one there was coming down the fireplace.
Now, are you looking to get rid of these woodpeckers, move them away further away?
No, I've got a wood pile full of bugs. They're welcome to them.
They're welcome to them.
Well, it's claiming its territory by drumming like that. So
yeah, Brad's got it right, yeah.
Is there a way, gentlemen, to let the woodpeckers come in and do what they naturally do to get the termites and wood-bound insects out of there without disturbing the framework of nature?
Well, you could try to exclude them from areas where they're doing damage, you know, by screening it or, covering it in some way. But if there are insects or bugs that are behind the siding, why, they're going to drill a hole in it and try to get to it.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 on your FM dial. This is KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. It's Nature in the City here on Central Standard. Our regular guests are in the house with us, describing things that get a little wild out there in the metro. Joe Warner, biologist and urban ecologist, and Larry Rizzo, a natural history biologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation and the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center, which I encourage you to check out. It's right over here on Truce, right across the street from KCUR Studios. Kansas City, are there any unique animal and plant life that you believe might not belong in the metro area and want to know if these species of animal or natural events are native to this area? Call 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888 and discuss it with our Nature in the City experts. Or you can hit us up on Facebook. Our Twitter handle is at KCURCST. Email is centralstandard@kcur.org. Let's go to Patty in Leawood. Patty, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. I have a question about robins. I have some weeds in my garden that I always let grow because the robins like to eat the berries, and I believe it's called a pokeweed, and they have dark purple berries in the late summer or early fall when the robins are getting ready to migrate. And one day I'll look out, and there'll be 10 or 20 robins on one of these bushes or these weedy plants eating all the berries. And then my mom read or heard somewhere that the berries were actually bad for them and that they might harm them in some way. And I was wondering what the expert said about that.
Thank you, Patty, for your question. Can we address Patty's question about the berries?
Sure. No, the berries will absolutely not hurt robins. It's a great food source, just as you've witnessed. Robins love that species, and it is time to their fall migration pretty closely. Parts of the poke, now the poke plant is well known as far as a green that many people eat, particularly in the old days, mm-hmm. we should say. But you have to pick it when it's young, otherwise it can cause problems to people if right. you eat the plant. But no harm in birds eating the berries. And I don't know if people can eat the berries or not, I guess, but I don't know that they taste good.
I don't know. I know they're used as a dye.
Yeah, they will stain very nicely if you get them on you.
It's Nature in the City here on Central Standard. Are there any unique animals or plant life that you believe might not belong here? That's the question on the table here. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Facebook, Twitter, and email at centralstandard@kcur.org are all options here. And Larry and Joe, as we pose that question to our audience on strange sightings, there are events coming up with the Missouri Department of Conservation February 26th through March 3rd, the National Invasive Species Awareness Week. It's coming up. Larry, tell us what the department is up to with that awareness week, and we'll also get Joe in on some of the mm-hmm. invasive species that are coming to town or already in town and wreaking havoc. Larry?
Yeah, that's a national designation. It's something that we're helping to publicize, and it's not something I guess we're celebrating per se, because it's not a fair.
No, not celebrating.
It's not
what
a cheery topic.
Yeah, what are you doing?
I'm trying to raise awareness.
To be aware of?
Yeah, about invasive species, which is a very serious topic. The second leading cause of native plants and animals becoming endangered or extinct, and it's a good thing to mention and to call attention to this time of year. I think, particularly in urban areas, because people are thinking about what to plant, perhaps. Mm-hmm. New trees, shrubs, or vines that they might want to plant in their home landscaping. And unfortunately, I won't say a lot, but some of those species that are still being sold commercially and are perfectly legal to sell commercially are highly invasive and mm-hmm. things that we just assume not people not plant in their yards.
Well, getting into animals that tend to be around vegetation, we have three culprits of invasive species: the Asian longhorn beetle, the emerald mm-hmm. ash borer, and the gypsy moth, all mm-hmm. destructive forest pets. What's the profiles here, Joe Warner?
Well, you know, of course, the Missouri Conservation Department and the U.S. Forest Service has been watching, you know, these particular organisms expand their range over the last, gosh, many, many, many years, and keep track of that. They put traps out to try to attract them to see if they're in a particular area. You know, they just can devastate the forest, kill the trees.
Out of these three, Larry, the longhorn beetle, the Asian longhorn beetle, the emerald ash borer, and the gypsy moth, which is wreaking the most havoc in these forest areas?
Well, the gypsy moth has been around a long time, and it's kind of slowly expanded its front towards us. We've had some spot infestations of it, but so far has not reached Missouri in big numbers. The emerald ash borer, foresters will tell you, has the potential to totally eliminate ash trees.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, yeah, it's
very
serious.
And where are we on that?
They have found a few, again, yeah. isolated populations of them, but they're not here in big numbers. One state I know that's really been devastated is up in Michigan in places. But that's why you'll see warnings. There's even a billboard I've seen around town of warning people about that bug. And one of the main ways it gets around and infests new areas is through people transporting firewood. Mm-hmm. So we urge people not to do that or be very careful with that.
Mike emailed us some photos of some long-tailed ducks to counteract some of this more serious conversation about invasive species. So thank you for the pictures of the duck, Mike, and anyone wanting to send in photos for this rendition of Nature in the City can do so at centralstandard@kcur.org. Dan in Kansas City, Missouri, welcome to Central Standard. We don't have Dan, so let's get to the walnut twig beetle, spreading thousands of canker diseases, which threatens Missouri's multi-million dollar black walnut industry. That's a very specific niche. The walnut twig beetle, what's up with that?
Well, that's another one they're worried about that's mm-hmm. spreading from the west to the east. Yeah, that has the potential to impact our black walnuts, that's for sure. That there's There's unfortunately a lot of them to be alarmed about when it comes to tree and forest pests that our foresters could certainly tell folks more about.
Tom writes in with the story. 2 weeks ago, he came home and saw what he thought was a peregrine falcon sitting in his driveway not too far from two bird feeders. He says he knows that there are a few peregrine falcons in downtown, Casey. Are they still there? And is that likely one of the two that have been seen in and around town?
Well, you know, there are other birds besides a peregrine. There's certainly a possibility it could have been a peregrine, but there are other birds that will be frequenting people's bird feeders. And, you know, sharp-shinned hawk and Cooper's hawk are becoming very common around here now.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I've seen some Cooper's hawks on nests already, so in someone's backyard, actually. So they're very active right now.
Yeah, I would second that. It's not impossible that it could have been a peregrine. They are still nesting downtown, but I would urge him, if he's not familiar with what a Cooper's hawk looked like, to look that one up mm-hmm. and see if that looked like it.
Brent and KC Moe, welcome to Central Standard.
Hello. Yeah, I noticed the past couple of years it seems like the starling population has gone down, and you know, I know they're indigenous to Europe, so I was curious, is there some sort of program that's been decreasing their numbers, or have they just moved out of my area?
Brent thinks the starlings are dissipating. Is there any merit to that?
I have not noticed that. I hope it's true.
Yeah, I haven't heard that at all. You know, of course, that's another invasive species, as the English sparrow is. And the sparrow population, I think that some of the data that's been generated through bird counts, you know, like the one we were talking about, you know, coming up this weekend, and in addition to that Christmas bird count, breeding bird count, I think that the English sparrow population has been declining somewhat, but the starlings, I'm not aware that that's been dropping. It would be good, because one of the big problems, of course, is that they will displace other birds, native birds, at nesting sites, especially in cavities and trees.
Speaking of invasive species, feral hogs damaging wildlife habitats and agricultural crops and carrying diseases that may affect livestock and, even more important, humans. Feral hogs.
Very serious problem, one the Department of Conservation has and is and will continue to invest a lot of manpower and money into eradicating. They're serious ecological threat, particularly in the Ozarks and in agricultural areas.
Where are these feral hogs coming from, and what are their characteristics?
Well, they come from people often intentionally releasing them, or in the case of the Ozarks, it's could have even been holdouts there from the free-range days in the Depression mm-hmm. era. But one characteristic about hogs is they very quickly revert to their ancestral form. They within a generation or two will start growing longer hair, longer tusks, and
like boars.
Yeah, yeah, become more wild looking. And of course, a hog can eat just about anything out there, and they do. And do a lot of destruction by their rooting around.
So these are hogs that got out and could easily revert to their ancestral
exactly.
origins and got out. How do we spot one of those versus just a regular farm?
Well,
hog?
I think you'll know by looking at them. Like I said, they'll have longer hair, and they'll just appear differently. They'll be very shy of humans. They're smart animals. They have a high reproductive potential. It's a really serious problem. And one thing I might mention that's worth mentioning sometimes, because people will hear this and become quite confused. In some cases, the Department of Conservation is opposed to hunting feral hogs, and that doesn't seem to make sense because we want to get rid of them. But what happens is hunting them seems to drive some people, unfortunately, to releasing them. It creates its own sort of economy. And demand for feral hogs. So in some cases, the more people hunt them, the more we have, as people keep releasing them. So if you ever hear that we're opposed to hunting feral hogs, or some agency is opposed to hunting them, that's why.
And they're starting to expand the range into the southern part of the metro area here. So it's something that we're going to be seeing in the Kansas City area more and more of.
Hillary in the West Plaza, thank you for calling Central Standard.
Oh, thank you. First of all, I'd like to say just very quickly, thank you for talking about nature in the cities. People often think they have to go out to the country to see nature, and we have it right here.
Good point.
And Secondly, I'm a landscape architect. I do a lot with native plants and with worm castings and composting and that sort of thing for feeding plants, not using chemicals. Are there ways of protecting trees we have now, like black walnut, and are there other things that we can plant to sort of confuse pests and not be a target?
Good question from Hillary.
Hillary, I'm not aware of any strategies like that that will work. In some cases, you can protect individual trees by injecting certain things into them. But as you can imagine, that's extremely expensive and not practical to do on a large scale. So unfortunately, the prognosis with some of these pests is not very good.
I think being aware of the problem and spotting it and then taking action, I think, Hillary, is probably one of the best things that an individual can do.
Gentlemen, the last item on the invasive species list, the bighead black and silver carp, which could drastically alter the food chain of lakes and streams with consequences that up to this point remain uncertain. What do we know about this type of carp?
It's a serious problem. Again, there, the Missouri River is full of them, the Mississippi River as well. And, of course, the chances of us getting a handle on that population is not very good either. What you can hope for, and maybe this is what we're seeing with things like the house sparrow and possibly the starling, is in time when these animals, they explode population-wise because they're not limited by anything here, predators or diseases. Over time and generations, sometimes that can catch up to them a little bit and they'll have a plateau, but unfortunately probably always going to be with us.
Well, February 26th through March 3rd is National Invasive Species Awareness Month, and we've been looking at beetles and feral hogs and carp in our local area in the KC Metro, so be on the lookout for that. This is Nature in the City. Our guests are Joe Warner, a biologist and urban ecologist, and Larry Rizzo, a natural history biologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation and the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center. Always a pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on Central Standard.
Thank you,
Jablon. It's fun.
And tune in tomorrow for the Walt Bodine Show with your history host, Monroe Dodd. Central Standard is produced by Andreas Lindsay, executive produced by Bill Anderson. And we have help from Tamika Weatherspoon and Charlie Upchurch. Kim Noble is our announcer. Emily Muter manages our website, kcur.org. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney. And what you're hearing right now, the outro, is by The Wilnots. Up to Date is next with The Book Doctors. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.